This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. India reported over 40,900 new coronavirus cases on Saturday, the biggest daily jump in nearly 4 months, with its richest state, Maharashtra, accounting for more than half the infections. Death rose by 188 to over 159,400, the health ministry reported, underscoring a resurgence of the virus in the world's third worst affected country after the United States and Brazil. The U.S. government has halved the acceptable distance between students who are wearing masks to at least 3 feet from at least 6 feet, potentially easing the path for schools that have struggled to reopen under previous guidelines. The new recommendations from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is a boost to the Biden administration's goal of reopening in-person learning for millions of public school students without sparking coronavirus outbreaks. A third senator has died of COVID-19 in Brazil, raising questions around precautions taken in the country's Congress, where as many as one in three lawmakers has been infected with the virus, which is devastating Latin America's largest nation. Senator Major Olympio, a former policeman who backed and later fell out with far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, was declared brain dead by doctors at a São Paulo hospital where he had been in intensive care for 3 weeks. Many countries are resuming use of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine after the European Medicines Agency and the World Health Organization said the benefits outweighed the risks following investigations into reports of blood clots. At least 17 countries in Europe had suspended or delayed use of the vaccine after reports of people being admitted to hospitals with clotting. This is VOA News. Palestinians took another step in preparations for their first parliamentary elections in 15 years on Saturday, opening registration offices to admit the political parties and independent candidates that will take part. The May 22nd election in the West Bank and Gaza is part of a broader push for reconciliation between President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction and rival Islamist group Hamas. This is seen as vital to building broader support for any future statehood talks with Israel, which have been frozen since 2014. The last time a parliamentary ballot was held was in 2006, and Hamas emerged as the surprise victor. A power struggle ensued, and in 2007, after weeks of fighting that left dozens dead, the Islamist group seized control of Gaza from forces loyal to Abbas. Abbas's authority has limited control over the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The United States would like to elevate and strengthen security ties with India, especially in information sharing and logistics, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin told his Indian counterpart on Saturday. Austin is making the first visit by a top member of U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to India as part of efforts to forge an alliance of countries seeking to push back against China's assertiveness in the region. The leaders of the United States, India, Australia, and Japan, countries together known as the Quad, held a first summit last week, pledging to work together for a free and open Indo-Pacific and to cooperate on maritime and cybersecurity. After meeting with Austin, India's defense minister said they focused on expanding military-to-military engagement, information sharing, cooperation in emerging sectors of defense, and mutual logistics support. He also urged U.S. industry to invest in India's defense sector, citing what he called liberalized foreign direct investment policies. Austin met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on his arrival in New Delhi on Friday, and he leaves on Sunday. In Australia, record rains and widespread flooding prompted evacuations along Australia's east coast Saturday and threatened the most serious overflow of Sydney's main reservoir in 30 years, officials said. Authorities warned of potentially life-threatening flash floods as the torrential rains pummeled a vast coastal region already soaked by an unusually wet summer. Via remote, Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The way we have observed her for many years, she is not happy to see people living in difficult situations or conditions. So my belief is that she will create a conducive environment for political participation in our country.
Tanzania installs a new president.
I think what we should stress here is when you're a journalist and you belong to a political party, what happens when you go to cover that story? And that is the issue of professionalism. Are you able to hold the qualifications of being a professional reporter, regardless of your feelings?
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni files a defamation lawsuit against a leading newspaper. We'll have a reaction from the Ugandan Journalists Association.
Let it be a protest. Congolese people who are coming on the street and telling Sassou Nguesso they don't believe in this election and it's time for him to get out of power. It's time for him to go. He's been in power almost for 40 years now. People, Congolese people, are sick and tired of having this man as the president of that country.
And in the Congo Republic, voters go to the polls to choose a new president Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Tanzania, newly installed President Samia Suluhu Hassan is calling for national unity. She's also appealing for citizens to look forward with hope and confidence. This following the death of President John Pombe Magufuli. Her swearing-in makes Ms. Suluhu Hassan the first female head of state in the 58-million-strong East African country. Faraja Lugume, a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam, says remarks from the new leader are warm, encouraging, and welcoming. He also says expectations are high about possible policy changes under the new administration. This, he says, includes free speech, women's empowerment, and dialogue with opposition and civil society groups who hold different views on governance. Lugume tells me that the new president appears to hold a sharply different perspective from her predecessor.
It's a new experience to have a woman president, but majority of Tanzanians have been happy. They have welcomed her. And they wish he would change the situation. He will make things better. And sometimes some of them are hopeful that the good things that the former president who passed away had started, that huge or mega projects like Nyerere Hydroelectric Dam project that is constructed, they hope she will finish the project, but also standard gauge railway line. They are hoping she will finish the project, but that depends on who will be appointed as the vice president and who will be the prime minister. The team will make sure everything goes right. But in her speech, she said she wants to embrace all Tanzanians and to close the old chapter and to build or to create a new chapter for Tanzanians. I think that statement made many Tanzanians hopeful that things might change to be better than it was before.
But do you see any policy changes that she might decide to undertake since she was instrumental in supporting President Magufuli's policies when it comes to development and the fight against corruption in Tanzania?
I think Mrs. Hassan might be different from Magufuli in terms of policies. There are some policies that might change, I believe, because there are things like defending the rights of women, but she couldn't be so brave to raise the voices when the former president was in the office. And sometimes people are a bit curious or a bit intrigued to see whether Madam President will repeal some of the policies and create new policies. But it seems there is a possibility for her to do that. So the perspective or the approach of dealing with politics for Madam President might be different.
Faraja, when it comes to the issue of the global coronavirus pandemic, we all know the stance the deceased president took. Do you foresee newly sworn in President Hassan to take a different approach in order to prevent the spread of the disease in Tanzania?
So my expectation is that she might take a different approach. But however, I don't think the approach that she will take will be very much different from what the predecessor had believed. Although she might allow for the sharing of data, she might be strong in telling people to take precautions like wearing masks, social distances, etc. But I don't think if there will be any decision about lockdown or about closing the borders or about closing the businesses so that to protect people, closing the institutions so that people can stay at home. I don't think there's any issue that will come like working from home so that people can avoid gatherings or social gatherings. I don't think that will happen, but rather I think she will insist more on precautionary measures to be taken against the COVID-19.
How do you expect Madam President Hassan to engage the opposition and civil society groups? What are your expectations in that directive?
My expectation is based on the fact that Madam President has been in many years friendly with opposition politicians, and she has been tolerant to opposing ideas, and she understands that people differ in ideas, people differ in opinions, but also people differ in approaching issues. And to her, the way we have observed her for many years, she's not happy to see people living in difficult situations or conditions. So my belief is that she will create a conducive environment for political participation in our country. And I believe also that she might also find an opportunity to meet opposition leaders in our country so as to discuss some of the issues of national interest, but also to allow media to write or to report things as they are, because that will also help her to understand the situation, to help her to understand the feelings, but also to gauge the perceptions of Tanzanians.
Faraja Logome is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian capital, Dodoma. The Ugandan Journalists Association has expressed concern about President Yoweri Museveni's decision to file a defamation lawsuit against the Daily Monitor, a major Ugandan newspaper. The group vowed to provide additional legal support to the paper as part of the effort, it says, to defend free speech as enshrined in the Constitution. This after President Museveni filed a suit at the High Court accusing the Daily Monitor of malicious allegations against him. The newspaper had published an article suggesting the president and his close associates have secretly been vaccinated against the coronavirus, an allegation the president sharply denies. The paper quoted from an article that had earlier appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Critics say the president's action and subsequent threat to bankrupt the publication is yet another indication of his intolerance of dissent and the media. Matthias Rukundo is the president of the Uganda Journalists Association. He tells me that the president could have used other established measures in the Constitution to address his concerns rather than resort to legal action and threat to bankrupt the newspaper.
The association has taken this issue in two ways. One, we appreciate that President Museveni recognizes the importance of lawful processes to resolve a difference. As any other citizen, he has an opportunity and a right to go to court to enforce his rights or seek redress in case he thinks he was offended by the article. But also, on the other hand, as advocates for the rights of journalists, we believe this will actually be a bad gesture to the future journalists and those that are practicing journalism, but also entirely to the independence of media. Because presidents in Africa are not small people. So by the time the president comes for a newspaper, a Daily Monitor, and is willing to take them on, make them bankrupt, as he actually swears to, I think it is a bad precedent for the media of Uganda. It's a bad precedent for the practice of independence media. It's a bad precedent for the media space that we advocate for on every day cry that we make into the country.
Well, Mathias, some people are suggesting that the suit against the Daily Monitor could be seen as an intimidation tactic, yet again deployed by the president himself to go after a newspaper. His supporters are saying that, well, if a news organization would use the free press to malign somebody, then it needs to be held accountable. What is your take?
It's a believable fact that government, by their nature, can use different means to really inflict pain, but also attempt to silence you in all different ways. But I also want to believe that as we advocate for an independent media, a free space for media, we should also allow the communities that we serve to hold us accountable where we go wrong. We do not want to stand and say we will never go wrong. But also, when we go wrong, are there avenues that can be employed? The approach might be different. I would suggest a different approach. But also, I take it as good feedback for me as a leader. So we do not want to stand and want to behave that we do not have professional challenges. They are there. But for a government that would want to support growth of media, you do not go that hard. I think we should be allowed to correct our mistakes where we do, because the laws that govern us give us those opportunities, give us the space for apology, give us the space to recorrect the story. We should exploit such avenues.
Is the Uganda Journalist Association going to support the Daily Monitor and the suit filed by President Museveni against it?
Peter, the association that I read, the Uganda Journalist Association, has been doing this since 1963, far way before I was born, far way before I thought of being a leader of this association. So I want to commit to you, and the answer is yes. We have already instructed a team of our lawyers, led by one Evans Ocheng, a senior criminal lawyer, and also a team of lawyers, of civil lawyers, that are going to interact with the legal department of Monitor, give legal support to them, exchange ideas, but also commit that whatever the element I would want from the association, we are ready to work with them. We've done this before. We've done it for journalists, and we commit that we are going to support the element in whichever way they would need our support.
Mathias, what impact do you think this lawsuit would have on the media fraternity in Uganda, particularly when a lot of people are expressing concern that the authorities seem to clamp down on dissent? Others are also saying that the media seem to side with the opposition, and that everything that you do seem to tarnish the reputation of the country, and for that matter, by extension, the president. How do you react to these two narratives?
Peter, I believe it is a matter of a fact that the government of Uganda adopted a multi-party system of governance in 2005, and that gave an open door to any Ugandan, male or female, who feels and wants to belong somewhere, to belong somewhere, somewhere to mean a political party. I know very many journalists in Uganda that support the ruling party, the NRM, the National Resistance Movement Party, other organization, but also know individuals that support other oppositional political parties. So if I want to say that journalists are collaborating and are working with the opposition, it's a fact, because they belong there. I think what we should stress here is, when you're a journalist and you belong to a political party, what happens when you go to cover that story? And that is the issue of professionalism. Are you able to hold the qualifications of being a professional reporter, regardless of your feelings?
Mathias Rukundo is the president of the Ugandan Journalists Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
In Congo Republic, voters go to the polls to choose a new president Sunday. President Denis Sassou Nguesso is seeking a fourth term. He faces challenges from seven opponents, including former Finance Minister Mathias Zohn and a son of a former Prime Minister Guy Brice Parfait-Kolela. Analysts say the other presidential candidates are unlikely to defeat the incumbent in the presidential poll. They argue that President Nguesso is too strong to be defeated. Some opposition and civil society groups are calling for a boycott, saying the election will not be free or fair. Supporters of the government reject the accusation as without merit. Tela Mamiabe is the executive director of the National Congress, a civil society group. He tells me that he is calling for peaceful protest to deliver a message to the incumbent president that it's about time he left power to make room for a new generation of leaders in the Congo Republic.
First of all, I want to say that Congo's election, let's call it what it is, it's a masquerade. It's a masquerade because there has not been any proper process of basically preparing this election in terms of being for it to be transparent and a free and fair election. That election is not going to be a free and fair election. It's a masquerade. It's another way for Mr. Sassou Nguesso to basically remain in power, because I can be a prophet today and tell you that at the end of this election, Sassou Nguesso will win the election.
But he has two opposition candidates who are challenging him. People think they are competent enough to defeat him. Why do you think they are incapable of doing so?
There are many candidates that could beat Sassou Nguesso. Sassou Nguesso is the least popular politician in Congo-Brazzaville. If there is a free and fair election, Mr. Sassou Nguesso will have less than 5% of the vote. I can guarantee you that. But because it's not a free and fair election, it's a masquerade, this is why we're saying do not participate in going to vote in that election, because at the end of the day, he's going to claim himself as the winner, right? Because the last person who has won the election in 2016 is either General Mokoko, who's still in jail right now, or you could see it as a Parfait-Kolela. One of those two won the presidential election in 4 years ago. But who's the president? Is Mr. Sassou Nguesso. He's going to claim his presidency.
Saying he's going to claim the election, some people would say, is just because you oppose his presidency. But supporters are saying the Electoral Commission declared who won the most votes across the length and breadth of the country. People go to the vote and they choose him as the president. Is that his fault that Congolese are voting to choose him as their next president or extend his presidency? People are voting for him, they argue. What do you say to that?
All the three branches of government do not exist. They belong to him. He's the executive, he's the judiciary, and he's the legislative. So when you have that, how can you talk about free and fair election? When the election commission is the exact same commission that was there 5 years ago, and the people are basically engaged to serve Sassou Nguesso, how do you expect that an election is going to be free and fair and transparent?
So are you therefore saying that these two candidates who are challenging him, you're talking about Parfait-Kolela, who used to be a cabinet minister until a fallout, and he has been a sharp critic of the president, are incapable of having any significant impact in Saturday's election?
What I will tell you is this. I am not so sure what Mr. Parfait-Kolela's plan B is, right? But I know that in order to go to this presidential election, you better have a plan B, because at the end of the day, whoever, whatever it's Mr. Nzong who win the election, whatever it's Mr. Kolela who really win the election by the vote, the people who Sassou Nguesso is going to proclaim himself to be president. That's number one. Number two, if they go to election, Sassou Nguesso is going to have a fake ballot so that he can proclaim himself president. Those are the two scenarios. There's no other scenario. There's not going to be a fair election in Congo-Brazzaville. So the candidates that are going into this election, I don't know why they're doing it. I cannot accuse them. I cannot point the finger at them. The only thing I'm saying, if they're going, I'm hoping they have a plan B, because I want to ask myself, what is Mr. Parfait-Kolela or Mr. Nzong will say after Sassou Nguesso has claimed or proclaimed himself as the winner of the election? What will they do?
Some opposition parties have boycotted the elections. Your organization is calling on voters not to go to the polls to vote, but the elections are going on anyway.
My organization, Mr. Cloutier, is calling for Congolese people to take on their own destiny, to get on the street and protest and come against Sassou Nguesso as they have the right to protest. I am calling for a protest, yes. Let it be peaceful. Let it be a protest. Congolese people who are coming on the street and telling Sassou Nguesso they don't believe in this election and it's time for him to get out of power. It's time for him to go. He's been in power almost for 40 years now. People, Congolese people are sick and tired of having this man as the president of that country.
Teilama Miabe is the executive director of the National Congress, a civil society group in Congo Republic. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The UN Refugee Agency says an armed group in the Democratic Republic of Congo is on a rampage that has killed nearly 200 people and forced tens of thousands to flee their homes since the start of this year. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 100 armed groups are active in the northeastern DRC in a perpetual fight for political power, control of natural resources, and survival. The UN Refugee Agency says one of them, the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, has become especially violent of late, killing nearly 200 civilians and displacing an estimated 40,000 in the DRC's North Kivu and Ituri provinces over the past 2.5 months. In less than 3 months, says UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch, the ADF allegedly has raided 25 villages, set fire to dozens of houses, and kidnapped more than 70 people.
It seems that since the beginning of the year, they have gone on a rampage in terms of raiding villages, killing civilians, kidnapping people, leaving people injured behind. And the consequences are really, really clear on the desperate population who have to flee in cases many times from each location to another.
Baluch says the main reasons given for the attacks reportedly include retaliation against military operations, search for food and medicine, and allegations that communities shared information on ADF positions. He says women and children constitute the majority of those fleeing their homes. The men, he says, stay behind to protect their property. He notes displaced people are living in dire conditions without shelter, food, water, or health care.
In the context of Ebola and the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, the lack of access to toilets, clean water, soap, and menstrual hygiene product is particularly of concern. In addition, families do not have enough essential items like blankets, sleeping mats, or cooking materials.
Before this recent mass displacement, the UNHCR was trying to assist an estimated 100,000 internally displaced people who had fled from previous armed attacks. Baluch says his agency has almost no money for this part of DRC and can only afford to help 4,400 families out of hundreds of thousands of people in need. The UNHCR is urgently appealing for $2 million to provide protection and humanitarian assistance to those displaced in Beni, North Kivu, and Irumu territory in Ituri. The agency needs $33 million for its humanitarian operation in the whole of eastern DRC. To date, only 5.5% of that amount has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva. VOA.
Hello, this is James Botti, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Benin, lawyers for opposition leader Rekia Madugu say conditions under which she is being held are inhumane and deplorable. At a press conference, lawyers called on the international community to visit the detention center where she is being held to determine the truth. Ms. Madugu, leader of the opposition party, the Democrats, is the first female presidential candidate of a major Beninese political party. She was recently arrested following a meeting with opposition figures in Porto Novo, including Moise Kereku, the son of former President Matthew Kereku, and Joel Aivo. Ms. Madugu is accused of plotting to disrupt the upcoming April 11 presidential election and of funding a plot to murder an influential authority. Supporters of the opposition party reject the charges as politically motivated to intimidate and harass opponents of the administration. Madugu was disqualified for failing to meet requirements needed to compete in the presidential poll. But her supporters say she was disqualified because she poses a threat to the re-election bid of incumbent President Patrice Talon. Barrister Sadiku Ayo Alao of the Benin Association of Strategic Studies for Africa warns that the opposition leader could die under the conditions she is being held. He tells me that it is important for the authorities to ensure that the judicial process is fair and transparent.
Detention conditions are very, very, very bad. This lady may end by being poisoned because she cannot eat the food which the parents are bringing to her. If they are authorized to see her and bring food, they can do it only twice a week for 5 minutes. A person who has not been sentenced, she has not been listened to, and there is no evidence of any accusation against the person, and they are torturing a lady of a mother of young children. How can you believe that a country like Benin, which is supposed to be a democratic country, can treat a mother like that? This prison of Akomiserete is not supposed to have women in the site. Because they want to put this Rekiatu in jail, they brought 5 new women in the same room.
Sadiku, the situation some people are suggesting is that if she's being treated equally like other prisoners and being housed or being in detention in the same conditions, why should she be treated differently as her case proceeds through the judicial system in Benin?
No, in prison, in the administrative prison, you have to know which type of prison it is. It's the international prison of ICTR. You know, ICTR is the tribunal for Rwanda. The UN contributed to construct this tribunal, and it's supposed to be an international prison. But at the side of this prison, they have national detainees in the prison. And in the prison, ordinary families used to bring food to the people because they know that the food in the prisons is not acceptable for any reasonable person, and the families are always authorized. But in the case of Madugu, the visits are permitted every day. They have an hour for visits. But because of this lady, they put special rules specially for her. They even changed the staff of the prison because they have been accused by government of giving her a good treatment.
Ms. Rekia is accused of trying to destabilize Benin and trying to undermine the upcoming elections. So don't you think that the government has a constitutional mandate to ensure the country's political situation is not disturbed, to ensure peace and tranquility, and to ensure the country's territorial integrity is protected?
Yes, if you have such an accusation, it means that the issue has been properly investigated and they have evidence. Shedeji has not been even asked the question of the accusation, and the people who are supposed to accuse her, one of them says, I never saw her in my life. The second one is supposed to be her cousin, to whom she gave money for a specific task. But they did not even ask, investigate, confront the people, know if the accusation is could be real or not. They just put her in jail. There was no investigation. They went to this supposed court, Create Court, which is not a court. It's simply an administration to jail the opposition party's leader. And they receive instruction directly from government. It's not a court.
Are you therefore saying, as a lawyer, that the judiciary as you have it right now in Benin is not independent? Are you not casting an aspersion or undermining the...
Let me explain something to you. We have ordinary courts, normal courts. Some of them are criminal courts. They have been there since more than 50 years. Those are our courts. Even though that these magistrates in the normal courts are under the control of government, the government now arranged since 3 years to create a new criminal court called CREATE, which did not obey to any ordinary law. They create special law. And this is under this special law and under this special authority of government, they are putting opposition parties in jail. You have to understand, it's not an ordinary court. It's out of the ordinary legal system of Benin. This is why some lawyers refuse to appear before that court.
Barrister Sadiku Ayo Alao of the Benin Association of Strategic Studies for Africa, he spoke with me from the Beninese capital, Cotonou. When Burkina Faso's former president, Blaise Compaoré, fled a 2014 uprising to Ivory Coast, he left behind a private zoo of exotic animals. The animals were starving to death until a non-profit stepped in to rescue them and this year reopened the zoo to the public. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from Zaniari, Burkina Faso.
Former Burkina Faso president Blaise Compaoré left behind a private zoo that included crocodiles, gorillas, hippos and lions. He continued to pay for the zoo, but the management team neglected the animals. The Association for the Protection of Fauna and Flora in Burkina Faso last year found animals like lioness Alma emaciated and starving. Shanaz Hussaini is co-founder of the group.
Hussaini
said Alma probably had about 2 weeks left to live, maybe even just a matter of days. The fact that 1 year later she finds herself on her feet and eating is really a miracle, Hussaini added. The baboons, gorillas, porcupines and tigers were among the animals that didn't survive. But Alma and the other lionesses recovered, along with a host of other animals. The ex-president gave the APFFBF power of attorney over the animals, and the zoo was open to the public with a small entrance fee. Julian Bertioli is another of APFFBF's founders. The major challenges have been to find funding for the animal feed, Bertioli says. It turned out to be much more expensive than they were expecting, he added. There are more than 40 animals at the zoo, many of which are carnivores. The zoo gets by on donations. Burkina Faso's violent insurgency hurt tourism and cut budgets for animal conservation. Benoit Douamba is General Director for Burkina Faso's National Office for Protected Areas. He says there were good periods before the onset of insecurity in 2017, when he had a budget of around $550,000. But for 2020 and 2021, he's not sure he'll even have a budget for $36,000. As for Alma the lioness, she has become a much-loved symbol of the zoo's recovery. Hussaini says when rescuers first arrived at the park, they found aggressive, angry animals. Today, she says, they're being cared for, and about 300 people visit the zoo every week. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Zinare, Burkina Faso.
Almost all schools in Kenya use high-emission wood-burning fuel to cook for students. But a government campaign ahead of this year's Earth Day, April 22, aims to transition schools to cleaner fuels by the end of this year. For VOA, Victoria Amunga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
At Alliance High School in Kiambu County, Kenya, workers cook lunch for 2,000 boys. The task is easier since the school, 3 months ago, switched from wood-burning fuel to liquid petroleum gas. Alliance High Principal William Mwangi says installing the systems for cleaner fuel in schools is demanding but doable.
You realize that we have used the same infrastructure like we had earlier. We have not changed. So the issue of saving on energy, or whatever energy is there, the same mechanism is the same.
A government campaign ahead of this year's Earth Day on April 22nd aims to transition all primary and secondary schools to cleaner fuels by the end of this year. The Clean Cooking Association of Kenya says if all schools switch from wood burning to gas fuels, it will stop more than 4% of the country's carbon emissions and save up to 40% on fuel budgets. But the group CEO David Njugi says limited access to technology is slowing the transition.
Some of these solutions are actually not made in Kenya. As much as we try to support locally available products, some of these technologies, which are very good technologies, or parts need to be imported and maybe assembled here and for use.
Most Kenyan schools cannot afford the high cost of switching to gas fuel for cooking. Since the campaign started this year, only 11 of Kenya's more than 35,000 schools have switched to cooking with cleaner fuel. Eric Naivasha, the Director of Energy and Environment at Pillar Equity Group, a financial company that is helping schools to fund the transition.
The second thing is the issue of financing. Inability of the institution to find resources to be able to pay for the upfront cost of installing the infrastructure. That challenge is what now we are trying to solve.
As part of the campaign, Kenya's National Environmental Management Authority, NEMA, is also addressing the lack of awareness of cleaner fuels. NEMA Chief Economist Obadiah Mungai says they are establishing centers called Green Points to teach the technology.
One of the things we do at the Green Points is to showcase renewable energy technologies, clean cooking solutions. We have schools coming to those Green Points to learn about these solutions and how to upscale them.
Kenya's government hopes the effort will help pick up the pace on reaching their goal of getting cleaner fuels in all schools. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Kiambu County.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Hivi kwa nini nije tutumue na dunia sio makazi? Hivi jineno neno vinisumbue hadi nishindwe kufanya kazi. Mama alisema mkuke kwa nguruwe kuishi na watu kazi. Achambia tukane atani uwesha same mzazi mzazi. Mweze nuna ficha na ficha mengi ninayo yaona. Ifupi nafunika kombe nikamini kesho nayo siku. Mapicha picha mapicha tithani kama ntapona. Wanangu wa mtani mniombe hivitani mchana na usiku. Nipe ujasiri kwenye kufanya maamuzi. Zidi nikomaza akili isinipoteze miruzi. Uniamsha alfajiri kama jana na juzi. Kupata kukosa ni siri na wendo Mungu baba mwamuzi. Dialogue yeah. wanaita mwanga kibonge tena kwa dharau wa kucheke wanachotaka wewonge waseme shukani ya punda mateke kama vipi demu wake tumgonge ndo anayempiga chura teke usipone wadonge basi ndo ujue hauna makeke sikia konde kwepambana mjini shule ukipata kidogo leta na nao tule chana nao anasemaga umezoea vya bure maana siku zote nyani alioni kundule kama baba na mama ndo nguzo ya dunia wapende wote sio wakike anacheka wakiume analia lia bila msada wowote. Mola nipe ujasiri kwenye kufanya maamuzi zidi nikomaza akili isinipoteze miruzi uniamsha alfajiri kama jana na juzi kupata kukosa ni siri na wendo Mungu baba muamuzi dialo
I'm not one of them. I'm innocent. عشان بعتبك ومن باب المحبة عايزك تسمعني حبة وتفهم قصدي ايه من العشان بعتبك ومن باب المحبة عايزك تسمعني حبة وتفهم قصدي ايه بايعني عشان بحبك صرت معك في ايه ده ما فيش حد تعمله يا حبيبي اللي تعملك حل في قلبك وقوله من بعد مين فضلك ده ما فيش حد تعمله يا حبيبي اللي تعملك حل في قلبك وقوله من بعد مين فضلك من العشم بعد عايزك تسمعني حب وتفهم قصدي ايه قبل الزعل ما يكبر مش عايز اشيل في قلبي وابعد من غير ما اقولك راجع نفسك وفكر قبل الزعل ما يكبر مش عايز اشيل في قلبي وابعد من غير ما اقولك بايعني عشان بحبك يبقى ترد الغلاوة جرح وبعد قصرت معاك في ايه ده ما فيش حد تعمله يا حبيبي اللي تعملك حل في قلبك وقوله من بعد مين فضلك ده ما فيش حد تعمله يا حبيبي اللي تعملك حل في قلبك وقوله من بعد مين فضلك من العشم بعد من باب المحبة عايزك تسمعني حبة وتفهم قصدي ايه
Oh, popo. It come make me to the follow you. If you nana me, wanna look better, get look better, raise it fair.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impube, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a braggart is recognized by his headgear. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.